the latest from Ukraine on the anniversary of Russia's invasion.
I want them to give us something for all of the money that we put up. So we're asking for rare earth and oil, anything we can get.
Israel pauses the hostage for prisoner exchanges.
A member of the Hamas Political Bureau said in a statement the humiliation claim was false and a pretext to evade Israel's obligations under the ceasefire agreement.
And what we know about the M23 rebel group in the DRC.
There's been a series of United Nations investigative reports over the last 3 years. They've said report after report that Rwanda is arming and supporting the M23 and in fact escalating that support.
Today is Monday, February 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. Monday is the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. As U.S. President Donald Trump reiterated the need to put an end to the war, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he'd be willing to step down if it would help achieve peace, adding he'd also do it if it meant Ukraine would be granted NATO membership. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the details.
Monday marks the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the stakes to bring the conflict to an end are high, U.S. President Donald Trump stressed once more when addressing the Conservative Political Action Conference on Saturday.
But it's got to end. It's a horrible, horrible thing to watch. I'm dealing with President Zelensky. I'm dealing with President Putin.
Trump also referenced a deal in the works that would grant the U.S. rights to access Ukrainian natural resources in return for the military aid America has given to Kyiv to fight the war.
I want them to give us something for all of the money that we put up. So we're asking for rare earth and oil, anything we can get.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should work with the Trump administration, especially with respect to economic cooperation, said Republican Representative Mike Lawler when interviewed Sunday on ABC's This Week show.
The United States has invested hundreds of billions of dollars to support Ukraine. And when this war is finally over, Ukraine is going to need significant investment to rebuild.
During a forum in Kyiv on Sunday, President Zelensky expressed readiness to continue the dialogue with the U.S. as a partner and hinted he'd be willing to step aside for the sake of peace.
If to achieve peace you really need me to give up my post, I'm ready. I can trade it for NATO if there are such conditions.
Democratic Senator Jack Reed told ABC the U.S. should work closely with both the Russian and the Ukrainian leadership in the peace negotiations, but he anticipates some challenges ahead.
And my sense is that the recriminations by the Russians against Ukrainians after this settlement, if it happens, will be dire indeed, that they will deliberately hunt down and destroy anyone they think is was an opponent of them.
Meanwhile, in Russia, President Vladimir Putin participated in ceremonies marking Defender of the Fatherland Day Sunday. He also handed out medals to soldiers fighting in Ukraine and pledged to keep supporting his troops with new and modern weapons and equipment. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
For a deeper dive into what's happening in Ukraine, the rare earth deal, the anniversary of the invasion, and perhaps most notable, President Zelensky's offer to leave office, I'm joined by our Kyiv correspondent, Anna Chernikova.
Basically, at the very beginning of his press conference, he was asked if he is ready to leave the position of the president in exchange for peace. And President Zelensky said that he is absolutely ready to leave and to give the position to whoever would be elected next by the Ukrainian nation. And he is ready to leave and he in exchange for peace or in exchange of the Ukrainian membership in NATO. So this was actually a question amid of the speculations which we're discussing and hearing about for the past weeks that Ukraine, that President Zelensky doesn't want to hold elections and he's basically, because he basically wants to remain president.
So this was essentially to refute charges by the U.S. president that he's a dictator.
Well, kind of, yes, we can say it like that as well. He actually was asked about that, about the fact that he was called a dictator without elections by President Trump. And he replied to that that, well, it's not really, of course, he was not really happy to hear that, and it's really not a nice thing to hear, but he does not consider himself a dictator, and basically he is in support of elections.
So moving on, there was another topic discussed in that press conference. It was the deal between the United States and Ukraine for access to rare earth minerals. And as of now, Ukraine hasn't accepted the American offer. Did President Zelensky say why? What's he looking for?
President Zelensky was asked this question. Probably it was the most popular question during the press conference. And his reply was that the main issue is that this agreement does not include the description of security guarantees that Ukraine will get. And this is the main issue. And this is the main thing that Ukraine wants to see in this agreement and that Ukraine basically demand. So he, in general, he said that Ukraine is ready to sign, but Ukraine wants security guarantees to be included.
And on Monday is the anniversary of the invasion, the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Let's go back 3 years ago. Did you think we would still be talking about the invasion 3 years later? What did you think would happen?
Well, a very good question. You know, I think that on this day 3 years ago, I didn't really think about it. The main, you know, thing that was going through my mind is how to keep my family safe, how to keep myself safe, and what to do, basically, whether to leave Kyiv or to stay. In a couple of days, of course, when, you know, this realization of what had happened, when it finally, you know, was settled in mind, me personally, I had no idea how long will it take, but I had a clear understanding that it's for a long time. So it was no hope that it will end soon, especially after Ukraine survived these first 3 days. Everyone was talking about that Ukraine has 3 days, and in 3 days, Russian army will be in the capital, in the city of Kyiv. So, and actually, it was really very close. Russian army was really close in the outskirts of Kyiv. It was very, very, very dangerous, and yeah, very close. So, I think that back then it was really not a lot of understanding of how it will turn, but I think that understanding that Ukraine will not give up, at least in inside of the country. So people were definitely not ready to, not even ready. People didn't even think about giving up. And it was a really strong unity. And I think that during these 3 years, probably at some point, this unity, well, has did not disappeared, but it became less. And I think this latest events, considering a new U.S. administration and the, you know, Ukraine-U.S. relations in these recent weeks, actually brought this unity that I remember from the very first days of full-scale invasion back. So now I have a feeling that the unity is very close to be as it was 3 years ago.
So interestingly, what you're saying is that the Trump administration, by being antagonistic towards Zelensky and Ukraine, had the opposite effect of what they wanted. It made Ukraine more united and wanting to stay and fight more.
Well, I think that this is a, you know, a natural reaction. At least it's very common for Ukrainians when there is an attack, when there is a high danger. Ukrainians are keen to unite, and this is exactly what's happening. What happened 3 years ago, and what's happening now. So, yeah, it could be. It could be as it. And well, and this is, I think, that something that probably Russian Federation did not consider 3 years ago, and maybe a lot of politicians also do not consider when you know, choosing on how to try to, you know, to make Ukraine get to certain decisions, because this is the reaction that Ukrainian nation, well, is getting when the danger is very high.
And we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova reports for VOA from Kyiv. Anna, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Turning now to the Middle East. It's been a tense few days as Israel and Hamas trade accusations of humiliating hostages and prisoners. Reuters' Sean Hogan fills us in.
Hamas on Sunday condemned Israel's decision to postpone the release of over 600 Palestinian prisoners and detainees after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu demanded an end to its hostage handover ceremonies, calling them humiliating. Hamas has made hostages appear on stage in front of crowds before they are handed over as part of an exchange arranged under the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire. Coffins with hostage remains have also been carried through the large crowds. A member of the Hamas Political Bureau said in a statement the humiliation claim was false and a pretext to evade Israel's obligations under the ceasefire agreement. The official cited Israeli authorities' move to blindfold and tie the hands of Palestinian prisoners and detainees, as well as threats for them not to celebrate their releases, as examples of Israel's own humiliation tactics.
Today is a tragic day.
Netanyahu's office released a statement in the early hours of Sunday saying it would delay the release of the detained Palestinians until Hamas met its conditions. That included assurances that more hostages would be released. Israel's announcement also accused Hamas of repeatedly violating the month-old ceasefire. It came a day after Hamas handed over the last six surviving hostages as agreed in the first of three phases under the deal. The bodies of four dead Israeli captives were to be released next week. US President Donald Trump's Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff said on Sunday the US expects the second phase of the Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal to go forward and that he would visit the region in the coming week.
That's Sean Hogan of Reuters reporting for us. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Pope Francis remains in critical condition, battling double pneumonia and kidney failure. The Vatican says his prognosis is guarded because of the complexity of his clinical condition. The Pope was admitted to Rome's Gemelli Hospital on February 14th after having trouble breathing for several days. The Diocese of Rome held a special mass on Sunday evening to pray for the Pope. Pakistan has warned that thousands of Afghan nationals awaiting relocation and resettlement in the United States will be deported back to Afghanistan if their cases are rejected or not processed in time. Foreign Minister Ishaq Dar issued the warning during a television interview Saturday, noting that the U.S. has promised to relocate the Afghan community in question from Pakistan tentatively around September of this year. An American Airlines flight from New York to New Delhi landed safely in Rome on Sunday afternoon after it was diverted due to a security concern, which later proved to be non-credible, the airline said. The plane was inspected by law enforcement after landing at Leonardo da Vinci International Airport and cleared to redepart. Sources say that the plane was over the Caspian Sea when the airline warned the crew of a bomb threat. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at some domestic U.S. politics, New York City Mayor Eric Adams is facing mounting legal and political pressure over bribery and campaign finance charges. Aaron Rainin reports from New York.
Mayor Eric Adams' bribery and campaign finance trial, originally set for mid-April, has been delayed by a federal judge after the Trump administration's Justice Department requested the case to be dismissed. Nima Ramani is a former federal prosecutor.
Judge Dale Ho took the April trial date off calendar, but he didn't dismiss the case, at least not yet. He appointed a special counsel, Paul Clement, to argue against the Department of Justice's position on dismissing the case.
Ramani says this legal maneuver is rarely used in federal court cases, making the judge's decision unusual.
It's not unprecedented, but it's not common. When the opposing parties want a case dismissed, it's almost always dismissed. The issue of what was the reason for the dismissal and is it appropriate? That's the issue that is going to be relitigated now that Clement is involved.
Some experts argue that the charges were improperly dismissed as part of a deal for Adams to cooperate with the Trump administration on migrant deportations from New York. Esther Fuchs is a political science professor at Columbia University.
Trump's proposal coming from the Washington office was dismissing the charges without prejudice against Mayor Adams in order, frankly, to keep him dangling so that they could keep control of him as it relates to the president's agenda, especially around immigration. So this was an intentional way for Trump to continue controlling the mayor of the city of New York.
Adams supporters insist he has done nothing wrong. Bishop Gerald Seabrooks is a Mayor Adams supporter.
There is not one iota of evidence that he have done something wrong with Trump. President Trump said so. Dissolved from the immigration said so. So these are opponents who never voted for him, who don't want him in office.
President Donald Trump also has come to Adams' defense.
It looked to me to be very political.
Kathy Hochul, fight back, remove Eric Adams.
Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul has ruled out removing Adams from office, opting instead for state oversight to monitor his administration. With legal delays, state oversight, and mounting scrutiny, Adams' political future remains uncertain. Aaron Rainin, VOA News, New York City.
More news from Europe, this time Germany. Diane Toe of Reuters fills us in on Sunday's election results.
Voters headed to polling stations across Germany on Sunday for an election that's set to restore power to the Conservatives, while the far right is forecast to achieve its best result yet in Europe's largest but struggling economy. Friedrich Merz's Conservative CDU-CSU bloc has been leading the polls. However, Merz's bloc is unlikely to win a majority given Germany's fragmented political landscape. And coalition talks are set to be tough, with parties divided over issues like migration and how to deal with the far-right party Alternative for Germany, or AfD. This could leave unpopular Chancellor Olaf Scholz in a caretaker role for months. His centre-left SPD is set for its worst result since World War II. A caretaker government would delay urgently needed policies to revive the economy. It would also create a leadership vacuum in the heart of Europe as it faces a host of challenges, including from U.S. President Donald Trump. Trump has made moves to cut a ceasefire deal between Russia and Ukraine without Europe's involvement and threatened a trade war. Polls show Germans are now feeling the most pessimistic about their living standards since the 2008 financial crisis. This woman voted for Merz with the hope that he has some economic knowledge and can rebuild the country. While this man said energy prices, the divided country and migration were issues that concerned him. Public attitudes towards migration have hardened from the country's previous refugees welcome culture. The anti-migrant AfD is on track to take second place for the first time in a national election. That's despite the stigma linked to the far right due to the country's Nazi past, which has triggered protests from many Germans. The AfD is unlikely to govern for now, as all mainstream parties have ruled out working with it. But some analysts believe its election gains could pave the way for an AfD win in 2029.
Reuters' Diane Toe with that report. And now to Africa. A Rwandan government minister and the spokesperson of the M23 rebel group were sanctioned last week by the United States for alleged involvement in the recent conflict in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. This comes after the M23 rebel group marched unopposed through Bukavu after taking over Goma, the region's biggest city, in late January. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Miriama Diallo, looks into the group's geopolitical motivations and what's next for this rebel movement that the DRC, the United Nations, and many foreign governments say is backed by Rwanda. These are claims that Kigali has denied.
The recent advances made by the M23 rebel military group in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo were not surprising because they are heavily armed and supported by Rwanda, a country with a strong military force, analysts tell VOA.
There's been a series of United Nations investigative reports over the last 3 years. They've said report after report that Rwanda is arming and supporting the M23 and, in fact, escalating that support. The latest report in December stated that Rwanda had 3,000 to 4,000 of its own troops in the DRC.
Sasha Lesnev is a senior policy advisor at The Century, a Washington NGO, on U.S.-Africa policy on human rights and conflict, and has testified before the U.S. Congress and the U.N. Security Council. While Rwanda denies the allegations, Lesnev says this crisis would have been preventable if the outside world had not taken its eyes off the situation recently.
They started rearming and reorganizing the M23 about 4 years ago. Then back in 2023, the United States brokered an intelligence sharing agreement and even sanctioned a Rwandan general for supporting the M23. Then Rwanda basically responded, promoting the general and continuing to escalate the situation, as well as the DRC reneging on its promise to stop arming and supporting the FDLR.
Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, accuses the DRC of backing FDLR, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, a Congo-based mainly Hutu rebel group that includes some fighters who were involved in the nation's 1994 genocide. The Tutsi-led M23, short for the March 23 movement, first seized control of Goma in 2012. The group was pushed back the next year by the Congolese army, some of its regional allies, and special operations forces of the UN Stabilization Mission in the DRC. The group has been among more than 130 armed groups operating in the eastern DRC, vying for control of valuable and abundant mineral wealth, including gold, diamonds, uranium, copper, also coltan and cobalt, major components in batteries used in electric cars, cell phones, and other electronics. Claude Gatebuke, a Rwandan genocide survivor, co-author of the book Survivors Uncensored, and co-founder of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network, says Rwanda is not the only backer of the M23.
It's Rwanda and Uganda, under the leadership of Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni, who are invading Congo to provide access to Congo's resources to the mostly Western multinationals. Again, this is all very well documented.
Mvemba Fezu Dizolele is the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies based in Washington.
Uganda has troops in DRC that are fighting conjointly with the Congolese against the ADF, which is the Allied Democratic Forces, an Islamist group that's based in that part of the country. So it's confusing in the sense that on one level, Ugandans are collaborating with the government of DRC. On the other hand, they've been reported to be engaged in this destabilization as well.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni, for the record, recently said he's ready to assist with peace initiatives in the DRC. Next on the agenda, M23 leaders have said they plan to go all the way to Kinshasa.
For sure, they are trying to carve off the Kivu. The problem that they have, they would have been able to do this a long time ago had it not been for the Congolese not wanting to be in separate countries. And so they're going to try to keep that area by force for as long as they can, set up their own government, and pretty much try to run a parallel country inside of the Congo.
A statement posted on X by the M23 on February 17th reiterated the group's call for a direct and sincere dialogue with the DRC government. Speaking at the Munich Security Conference last week, DRC's President Felix Tshisekedi criticized the outside world for not taking action against Rwanda in light of the escalating violence in his country. On Thursday, a Rwandan government minister and a spokesperson of the M23 rebel group were sanctioned by the United States for their alleged involvement in the recent escalation. In response, Rwandan Foreign Minister Olivier Nduhungirehe tells VOA the recent sanctions are unjustified.
These kind of punitive measures cannot contribute toward peace and stability in our region.
The government also says the country's only aim is a secure border and that for the last 3 years, the conflict has involved hostile forces, including Congolese armed forces and FDLR, among others, that have not been sanctioned. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.